Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to another installment of Two Legs. This is episode 213. We are mainly a solo Paul McCartney podcast dealing with the solo career of Paul McCartney. And joining me today is the co-founder of Two Legs and my partner, Thomas Hunyadi. Good evening, Tom.
Andy, my friend, it's good to see you. And I'm surprised we haven't covered what we're covering today.
Yes. Yeah, we've talked about it. Didn't know who I was, my name's Andy Nichols, also a co-host of Two Legs. But I think you knew that. We're just going to recap. I mean, we've been pretty busy. We had a flurry of shows. We had a bonus episode with Joan Borelli that we just did the other night, which was fantastic. A lot of good feedback and comments on that. So thank you those that watched it. And Joan, thank you again. She was absolutely tremendous in her stories about seeing Paul and going to Liverpool and London. Thank you so much for that again, Joan. But today on our show, we've done over the years where we pick a concert film or documentary and we let it play and talk about it. So today we're going to do a really kind of obscure one, but a very important one, especially in the pre-YouTube era, okay, in terms of footage.
Right.
And that is the 1986 Paul McCartney special. This is a homemade DVD version that I made. Tom's got the Laserdisc. Okay, this was specifically made just for the BBC, and it was filmed in 1986 as a promotional vehicle for the Press to Play album. And we're gonna start the documentary. It runs about 54 minutes. It's a YouTube version, so there's some stuff on there that is blocked out already, so we should be okay from the copyright gods on this one, I would think, because we're just using the YouTube version already. We're not airing anything. Anything that's blurted out needs to be blurred out. But what are your thoughts on this documentary, Tom? Did you know it before you watched it, or how? When was your first exposure to this one?
After in the YouTube years, probably like 10 years ago, whenever... somebody had said something about this 86 special and that it was on YouTube, and I tried to find it. And I did find bits and pieces. You know how you'll find like a TV show that's in blocks, you know, like 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there. And I remember something like that. But I mean, this is really important for the fact that, I mean, this is going to be your first time seeing some of the clips, unless you were there, you know. This was a relatively new discovery for me. I didn't know that this existed. I mean, especially since you said, I mean, this was done specifically for BBC, right?
Just for the BBC. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It was filmed in July of 86 at Abbey Road, and it aired in August of 86 on BBC One, and again in December on BBC Two. And it did get a home video release in the UK and in the US in November of 87. And I ended up buying a copy from one of the New York public libraries that were getting rid of it. And I said, I got to have this. It was probably in the 1990s. It was like, whoa, that's gold. Right. Took that, had that VHS, and then just made a home mock-up version of it on DVD for the collection. Mm. But if you've never seen it before, it's really good. It's Paul, you know, plugging Press to Play. You'll see some clips of him, you know, playing guitar, and, you know, cheapest video I've ever done, you know.
That's so cheesy. But obviously, thankfully, they didn't use that footage for the video. Mm. So.
No, yeah, he went into the underground and, you know, just did his thing with that classic video. But the interviewer is a guy by the name of Richard Skinner.
Yes.
Richard Skinner, who was a BBC employee, and he's the one who conducted the interview, and you'll see him on camera here. And there's a lot of this. So there's obviously a lot of Beatles footage. There is plenty of coverage about Wings in here. Paul talking about Back to the Egg. He refers to it as a Bombsept album when he's asked about it. He says, the interviewer says, what about, is that a concept album? You mean Bombsept. So it's Paul pretty honest about Wings too. So it's valuable for that as well, because you're getting, and again, as Tom mentioned, you're seeing some real, well, probably won't see this in the blocked out version, but, and I think as it is grayed out, but this documentary was the first time you saw any footage of wildlife pro shot anywhere, which later ended up being on Bruce McMouse, which we got in 2018.
It kind of, in a way, this is kind of like a career spanning, you know, mini documentary, if you will, at that point in time, because there's nothing really like this at
think about it, right? What's been? I mean, you've got Wings Over the World and Rock Show, those are concert right. films, but there's nothing kind of in depth in terms of analysis at all. But it did get a home video release, so it was released
right
as well. So,
yeah, and the thing is I mean, it does say, you know, MPL Communications Inc., but the MPL logo is nowhere on
on
the back here. So, you know, hopefully we don't get dinged for watching this.
I don't think we will. And one would think that if and when Press to Play, the archive comes out, you'll get this interview
right
attached as a bonus.
Right. Before we start, I do want to show one thing there, Sir Andy, if you don't
go
mind.
For it.
Really, really excited that I was able to get another day. And this is the Norway version. This is the one that I've really been looking forward to finding. And if you think this looks familiar, you are correct, because this is the one they used for the 2012 Record Store Day.
Yeah.
This is the same image they used for that release. So I'm really happy to have the original Norway Picture Sleeve 45 for my collection of Another Day.
And that's numbered copy. Yeah. What of Another Day on 45? A Baker's Dozen now, 12, Bob?
12 or 13 there, buddy.
That makes a Baker's Dozen now.
Yeah. So
cool.
Yeah.
Good find.
Yeah. It's a great one. When I saw it, eyes, you know, popped out and like, yes.
Get it. And you got a very appropriate shirt on today for this episode.
Yes, exactly.
It'll be Press to Play related. And
right. Yes. Now the funny thing is I ordered this shirt like 3 weeks before the fest, right? And I'm going, okay, I'm gonna take this to the fest with me, right?
Yeah.
It says extra large, so I got it. It came in the mail 2 days before I left for the fest. So naturally, first thing I did was I put it on a little too tight. Let's just
1986 extra large, so you know.
Yeah, exactly. 1986 extra larges were a little different than 2023 extra larges, my friend.
Just a bit. Just a bit. Well, we've grown as Americans in 30 years, yeah. Haven't we?
But Ken Michaels has one of these. What these are were promotional T-shirts for the Press to Play album. So they gave them to DJs around the world, maybe, or just around the U.S. I'm not 100% sure if it was worldwide as well. But yeah, I mean, it's this the Press like 45 picture sleeve. So
yeah, on a T-shirt.
Really cool. Yeah, on a T-shirt. So it was a great find.
Why don't you model it for her? Stand up.
Ah, funny guy. Look at you.
It's a rare thing.
It is.
You got a lot of fans out there, hon Yachty. Yeah. You got a lot of fans out there.
Oh, press. Yeah. You know,
that's a 1986 extra large, all right.
Yeah. So there you go. But glad to have it. Trust me, I will. You know, I'll lose some weight eventually, and it'll fit a little better. You know, but
good score.
Great shirt, though.
All right. Yeah. So without any further ado, let's get into the documentary. We're gonna change the layout of the screen here for you folks at home, and we're gonna go to the side, be a little smaller, and we have the full documentary right there. Again, this is a YouTuber. It's been up on his channel for God knows a long time.
I'll keep playing the same sort of music. Until we're about 40, because not when sort of old men playing for me to
this is...
they want to know at all about that sort of thing.
So, yeah, I'll pause this for a second, because
we thought about it, and
the fact that he's saying, you know, you can't be playing this, you know, up to when we're 40 is just hysterical now when you're thinking about it, right? Because
right.
Well, I think we first would have saw this image in what the Complete Beatles?
Complete Beatles, this footage would have been taken from, yeah. You know, which by this point was about 4 years old.
Right. Go ahead.
Probably the thing that John and I will do. We'll be write songs as we have been doing as a sort of sideline now. We'll probably develop that a bit more, we hope. Who knows, at 40 we may not know how to write songs anymore.
Right, so this was Prince's Trust footage.
Right.
Which is really cool.
I remember, you might want to turn it down just a touch.
Okay. And Elton wailing away there on the piano in this.
Yeah, but I remember watching this and just having a great time watching it. And they showed it a couple times, so every time that it was on, I tried to watch it.
Yeah. There's Elton.
Yep.
It's weird. They obscure the image, but the music gets through. Interesting.
Yeah. See, you would have thought that the image would have been fine.
Fine, and they'll just mute the music. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we got Mark Knopfler's going to rock out here in a little
yeah.
bit, too.
I always think this was the moment where Paul said he could start playing live again. You saw the energy right. back in his face here.
Yeah. Well, he looked like he's enjoying himself too.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, Abbey Road Studio 2. It must be a really nostalgic place for you. After all, it's where the Beatles always recorded.
Yeah, it's full of the memories, really.
To be able to go there whenever you want, pretty much, too.
This is where John would be standing when he did that girl.
And he's used the studio so many different specials.
I just remember him here, and we were all digging around the corner.
It was in Queenie Eye.
Screens. Well, most of the tracks we ever did, you know, were done in here. Down here. This is where, like, on the first recording session there, we did Love Me Do. And in the middle of the session, suddenly turned out that I had to sing one of the lines that I hadn't sung in rehearsal. Because John had been playing harmonica, and he used to go, wah, 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 love me do. And George wanted it continuous, so he gave me this love me do line. So I'm suddenly, oh, no, oh, God. And I'm quaking with nerves. We used to have everything worked out before we got to the studio, because you'd only have a day to make an album. Our first album was done in a day. So we used to come in here, it would be 10:30 till 1, lunch. 1:30 till 4 or something. Very civilized, you know. It's actually a real good way to work, actually, because you've got masses of stuff done.
Press to Play is your 15th album since McCartney back in 1970. Oh, does it get harder?
No, not really. 15th? No, I don't keep count myself. No, it doesn't get harder, no. It's interesting, you know, each time's a sort of different challenge. I always feel like it's a fresh album. I feel like it's the kind of first or second time I've ever made an album, but it isn't, it's the 15th.
The 15th it is. How do you approach actually making the album and who you're going to work with and things like that? How does it come together?
Well, I just feel like it's time to record again.
Second.
You know, there's no, they're just...
Because it's interesting what he's going to say here about, you know, strumming the guitar, you know, in front of John and whatever, and how they would write songs together and then,
right.
you know... And then he would introduce, you know, Eric Stewart, you know, writing with Eric Stewart for this album. Because, and then it would be funny because then what, like 3 years later, he'd tell the same story working with Elvis Costello.
Costello, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's just a feeling you get. You sort of think, I haven't had a record out for a while and time to get going. So I look around for musicians. This time I looked around for someone to work with because I didn't fancy working on my own. Sometimes I would fancy writing on my own, which I quite enjoy. This time I wanted to work with someone. And I kind of really remembered the way John and I used to write, which was basically across two acoustics, guitars. He'd have an acoustic album, and you sort of play at each other, you know. And you sort of, it's like looking in a mirror almost, because he'll think of a line and you rebound off it, you know. It's a great way to work, really. And I hadn't worked like that for a long time. So I knew Eric Stewart quite well, kind of socially and stuff. So I suggested, how about bringing your acoustic round? You know, we'll have a plonk. And
it's funny he doesn't mention, well, I just did three albums with him, too.
Right. Yeah, really involved. Broad Street, Press to Play, and Talk of War. Yeah.
Work, really.
Right.
And then the rest of the songs, I sort of just went into the studio because I was making my own new studio. Which was quite a big deal because I don't really know much about studios, so I had to rely on other people a lot. And then just to try out this new studio and to feel my way, I made up a couple of tracks on the spot, which is something I'll do more these days because recording's going a bit more that way.
How would you say the album's come out? On first hearing, it seems a little less commercial than Broad Street was.
I never know, you know, I can never tell, like, what's overtly commercial, what isn't. I mean, you know, it depends who's buying, really, you know, as to what's commercial. I don't like to try and really be very commercial because I think it'd all be a bit Eurovision if every single track was a kind of real snappy, catchy hit. Because, you know, that's your opportunity on an album is to expand a little bit more. So on some of the tracks, we've definitely gone anti-commercial.
and not try to hook them to
hilarious. This is great.
More yeah. on the plane. I can never tell you what albums are like. You know, you just got to sort it out yourself, really.
Darling. I was watching this yesterday, and I was just putting myself singing along to it. This is great. Love this song.
Maybe we could hit upon a word and something that the others hadn't heard. When you want me to love you, just tell me to press right there.
So happy he didn't use this for a video. They're gonna go away from this guitar solo.
Yeah. Oh, you stupid ads.
Oh, you ads.
Freaking ads on YouTube. What? Ridiculous. Pain in the ass.
Beetle boots.
There's Mal.
Yeah.
Darling, I know it really wouldn't be a crime. I say I want to love you all the time. But with all these people listening in, I don't know where I ought to begin. Maybe we should have a secret code.
I wonder if Linda would have been this. People
get ready to explode.
You know?
And what do you mean?
I wonder if Linda would have filmed stuff for a video for this as well.
Oh, maybe.
I'm right there. That's it, yeah. When you feel this stuff, don't understand.
Right. He wants her to tell him the price.
Right.
Cheapest video I've ever done.
When you first started writing, who were your strongest influences, do you think? Who were the people who most made you put pen to paper and maybe you imitated even slightly?
I think the first big influence on writing was Buddy Holly. And it wasn't just because we liked him, because there are a lot of other people we liked.
The scene coming up in here in a
I'm saying
is
we,
really
not the royal we. I mean, it means John
really
and
I, important.
That's when we started together. Buddy was a big influence because of his chords, because we'd only just started learning on guitar, and a lot of his songs were three-chord songs, A, D, and E. And we knew those three chords. And we're working on B7. But, so that was the thing, really. You know, you'd hear a record and you think, hey, you know, we could do that. And it inspired you, you know, I can do that. So a lot of our early songs, like Love Me Do, those kind of songs were like three-chord songs. So he was a very big influence. Carl Perkins was a big influence, too. Same kind of reason. There weren't too many chords. Elvis was a big influence, but not on the songwriting, more on the singing, as was Little Richard for me. I think my singing influences are Elvis.
Well, the backyard, right?
Well,
yeah, here, pause this here for a second. But so, correct me if I'm wrong, then when the Wingspan came out on DVD, there was the him doing Blackpool, with, and I think that's the same, during the same...
It's the backyard film. It's the backyard film, and it's the McCartney years, not Wingspan. I don't think.
Right. Is it? No, I think it is. It. Yeah, you might be right. It might.
I think
be
it's the McCartney years is where you get this. You get this footage cut into it. Yeah.
But I think they do show a snippet of it too in Wingspan.
That you're right, but definitely Blackpool. You hear
Blackpool,
and it's all from the same period. This
the
is
same
the backyard right. tape.
And there's a bootleg of this too, right?
Yes, there is.
Oh, how my heart yearns for you. Oh, baby. My Peggy Sue. Who will I love you? girl, and I want you, Peggy Sue.
Well, that date is wrong.
Oh, how my heart yearns for you. Oh, Peggy. My Peggy Sue. Ooh, 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 ooh. Well, I love you, girl, and I want you, Peggy Sue. Peggy Sue. Peggy Sue. Pretty, 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 pretty Peggy Sue.
So whoever his team was at that point in time, whoever was with MPL, had to have given BBC the footage.
I don't know what Pure McCartney songs are, you know. See,
see,
the thing about it,
Pure
when
McCartney,
you're doing
that's
it,
maybe where
you really
might have heard it, the term for the first time.
Because it's not your job.
Yeah, he asked him. Richard asked him, yourself, what's Pure McCartney track?
Pure McCartney.
Well, you know, yeah. Or DJs or whatever, who get time to listen all the time in those headphones, you know, twiddling their thumbs,
funny.
Biting pencils down the BBC. That's a good one. I don't like that. And so you actually don't spend much time looking at what is a McCartney song, what isn't. I think a lot of the things I've been criticised for in the past are things I didn't even know I was doing, really, till they told me.
This is a
see,
good
I'm
story,
really thinking it for the first time now. But probably that first McCartney album when I was, when the Beatles had broken up and I was on my own for the first time. And I got the four-track Studer in my living room. And just like this, kind of just started making up songs and stuff. And it was a very bare album, very, I like it, actually. So I like it as an album. But I took a few little risks. I didn't realize I was taking risks. I thought, again, I was just making an album, you know, like I still do. But listening to it now, it's very basic kind of album. Something like That Would Be Something, I think it's very me, very basic little thing. But Maybe I'm Amazed is probably the first real major.
Of course, we're going to go to the live version here.
Yes.
Sped up horribly, I might add, too. You gotta remember, we're talking, you know, almost 40 years ago here.
Yeah.
See now, but this clears YouTube, so we'll have to see.
Right. Well, all right. If that's what he had to do, was to speed it up a little bit.
Maybe.
The vocal a little bit.
Oh, it's definitely sped up. Hey, 34 years old here.
Well, I wonder if they should have had 1970 there. It was kind of 76, but,
yeah.
However, it was released as a single in 76.
In 77.
Is it late?
Right?
Early 77? Or late? Yeah. I don't remember.
Or late. Well, the album came out in December of 76.
Right.
So I think the single was after.
Introducing
oh, come on,
Afa
Nabala with the freaking ads.
On the outside.
In the middle of the song?
On the inside.
Yeah.
Freaking YouTube. First... Piss me off.
When the Beatles split up, did you find it actually writing alone difficult? Was it a liberation or was it actually much harder than you know?
No, it wasn't a liberation, no. It was very difficult, yeah. Because obviously, like, John was a big help because he was such a big talent.
Of course.
I think we both probably found it a little bit difficult not having that person across the acoustic to sort of try it all out on. In early days, you know, writing something like Saw Her Standing There, I
It's just one remembrance of mine of John kind of vetoing a line of mine. You know, we used to do it with each other, but just one
I remember. Beauty queen.
She was just 17, never been a beauty queen. He said, oh, stop. No. Way, you know, that one. Huh? And then it changed to, you know what I mean. But, yeah, that kind of help, obviously, was
that's the 80s look right there.
Oh, there, yeah, that's it, man.
I enjoyed it in a way, because it wasn't that much of a change, because I had written things like Yesterday. And
cool to see the camera turn on the interviewer. That never happens. Like, right. You never really see that too much.
I had written a lot of stuff on my own, because obviously John wasn't always there. He was sometimes out where he lived, and I'd get the urge to write. On my own.
But still it had to be filtered through the others before it was recorded.
It still had to be filtered through, yeah. Oh, it wasn't easy, Richard, let me tell you.
So who did you filter McCartney or Ram through? Who was the filter for that?
Just myself, really, I think. And friends. I mean, you know, I was still friends with the Beatles. I mean, I remember Ringo coming round one night and me sort of playing him some tracks and sort of getting his okay on him, you know, seeing if he liked them at all. But it was the beginning of me sort of stepping out on my own. It wasn't really my choice. You know, I would have preferred to stay with the group, really, but the group had just broken up. It had just come full circle. And there was no saving it, really, because we were in the middle of all those business troubles. And they were just getting so heavy that it had to give, you know. It was kind of a mixed blessing, really, because on the one hand, I missed John's help and his talent. I mean, one example I always give of John's greatness, I think, is I was sitting at the piano doing "It's Getting Better All the Time," better.
I think this was like new.
Couldn't get much.
This
worse.
Was pretty new.
Yeah,
telling that story
John,
then.
You know, I would have never thought of that.
You would think he would say the "Hey Jude,"
getting
you know,
better,
where
good,
he said, "No, you won't."
You know which is which
right.
I thought was great for the song. It just balanced it up. But that kind of thing I missed a lot.
And then we just cut to Helen Wheels, like randomly.
Yeah, which is kind of like out of place in a way.
Like we're talking about the Beatles and we're going to cut right to Helen Wheels.
Right.
You know, top 10 single from 73.
Right.
I mean, we're not going to go right to Band on the Run or Jet even. We're going to go right to Helen Wheels. I mean, come on. Biggest fan of this song, and it doesn't belong on the album. UK, you Band on the Run all the way. Cool shirt she's got on, though.
Yes. Hey, she knows what she's doing. Look at that. She could have been a prog keyboardist, right?
One of Ken Michael's trivia questions.
Yes.
Was like, but I mean, it made me sympathize with people on the dole because people said on the you'd hear people saying, well, you know, it's not so much just not having a job anymore, it's the feeling useless that's the thing, and that's how I felt. I felt like I didn't have a use anymore. You know, I'd been one of the Beatles, I'd been a bass player, and I'd been a co-writer with John. Suddenly, all that was taken away, and I just thought, well, am I any good on my own?
Okay, here's some rare footage. Ica rehearsals. Yep.
I think the most difficult thing was not so much the writing as the playing with the band, because I decided early on that I wanted to carry on being a singer, working with a band, and I had no band. So I thought, well, you know, if I don't sing for a year, it's going to get a bit croaky.
And then if I don't sing for 2 years, I'm going to sort of suddenly think, well, I'm not a singer anymore. And you can get rusty very quickly, actually, you know. So I decided to try. We went on the road. Boy, did we go on the road.
There was an edit there.
I mean,
the thing is, normally you go on the road, at least you book hotels.
You know, anyone books hotels. But we decided to really just busk the whole thing. So we had a tranny, and we just headed off up the motorway. We had the kids, a couple of dogs, the whole group, all our instruments. Oh, there was a U-Haul following behind with the roadies. Yeah. And we literally turned up at universities and stuff. We turned up at Nottingham University, was the first one. And we said, in fact, we didn't. I didn't say anything. I stayed in the van. Couldn't handle it. One of the lads, Ian Horn, actually, went in and said, well, you know, I've got Paul McCartney out in the van. I mean, do you want him on lunchtime tomorrow? And the students, you know, said, piss off, you know, get out of here. Really? You know, and they come out in the van to sort of check. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we love him. So we played that next lunch hour. 50p on the door. Reasonable. It was quite funny because we didn't know that many numbers. We were a very new band.
50p at the door.
And I think we had something like 11 numbers.
Oh, this is so...
Yes.
God damn, right. This shouldn't be obscured. This footage was like a treasure trove to see.
Right. Yeah.
Before the Bruce McManus release.
We have it now, but...
This was pro-shot footage of Wings doing Wildlife.
Right.
And I forget what town, I forget what city it's in. But to have pro-video shot footage of Wildlife was incredible to have back then. But I've never seen video obscured because of the copyright. Audio mute, I get.
Audio, yeah, right.
Watch us get a strike now. Your video has been flagged. It's all widely available now. You can get this on YouTube now. And if you have Bruce McManus.
There you go.
The idea you have for the Beatles, you wanted to take them out.
That's how it happened. Yeah. That was my kind of final idea on the Beatles, was that when we were starting to break up and stuff, I thought, well, our trouble is that we're not playing music, and our strength as the Beatles is that we were a great little band. If somebody would say, oh, how about Maggie May or something, we could always just do it. We had so much experience that we could knock up any number within 5 minutes just because we knew each other so well. And that had been my suggestion at the end of the Beatles. That had actually, I'd probably finished the Beatles when I made that suggestion, actually. Because I'd said that to John. I said, oh, well, I think we ought to do. Get back, do all
I
these little clubs, really work it all up again.
Rolling,
you know,
Stone
just be a great little band again. And we'd go and do an album.
So this,
maybe
I don't
do a
think
big
this
tour
is a new information.
And he didn't agree with that. He wanted to go in big, if anything.
Oh, there's
and,
that middle finger.
I think he chose that moment to sort of say, in fact, I was going to tell you, I'm leaving, you know. Jaws dropped everywhere, you know, and it was like, oh. Oh, we gave it 3 or 4 months after that to see if that was true or not, and in fact it was, you know. So then all sorts of silly things happened, you know. And we'd phone each other occasionally and say, do you think it's going to get back together? And say, well, I don't know, you know. But after 4 months, it was pretty much
definite that we wouldn't.
See, and that part's and not brought way, up a lot either.
In a way, it was a good thing.
I think George said it, and I think, you know, Paul says it here.
And there was a feeling in the air.
You know, the he's saying it right here. Well, you know, John did say that, you know, he's leaving, but we you know, we waited a couple months because we thought maybe, you know, he would have changed his mind.
And he didn't.
Yeah, and he didn't.
That we'd done about all we could do. And all it was going to do was we'd just carry on repeating ourselves.
You always made strenuous efforts to make it clear that Wings wasn't just a backing group, didn't you? That it was a complete band.
Yeah, well,
why?
I don't know, really. I mean, I think I've been accused of treating people just like sidemen, which I'd never meant to do.
This is a good story, too.
But if you're in a session and you want a song to go a particular kind of way and you start ordering people about, they can get a bit shirty about it, you know, say, oh, you're treating me just like a sideman. And there was a lot of that going around at the time. I'd been accused of that. In fact, we'd done a session with the Beatles where I think George and Ringo had got a little bit cheesed off at me ordering people around. I really didn't think it was ordering people around. I thought it was just helping with the session, you know. And in fact, what happened was I said, right, okay, you know, fair enough. You know, I hear what you're saying. I'll stop. So I got all very kind of introverted and didn't say anything. For about a couple of days, Ringo said, come on, produce it. You know, so it didn't work, you know, both ways. So with Wings, I was a bit conscious of that. I wanted to try and let people sort of, you know, be themselves. It worked out, though, on a few occasions. In fact, in this studio, we did My Love. Ballad that we were doing. And we'd worked it out, we'd rehearsed it, and we had a full orchestra. It was live, that was recorded live, played and sang live. And we had the whole orchestra all waiting, you know, for the downbeat. And Henry McCulloch, the Irish guitar player there, he comes over to me, and we're ready to go. I said, just a minute. What's that, Henry? He says, do you mind if I change the solo? Not at all. You know, you go ahead. And actually, it's one of the best solos he ever played.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is from James Paul McCartney.
Yeah. Yep. Not that great here, I don't think, but...
No, not like on the record.
Right.
Or in the video itself, you know.
Hairdo, man.
A lot of critics.
A mullet in full force.
Band on the Run that you actually sort of came of age, in fact, after your time in the Beatles. Would you agree with that?
No.
What do you agree?
I know what they mean, though. Yeah. I mean, you know, critics tend to take a very black and white overview of the thing, and that's the obvious thing to say, I think. You know, I think, if you're looking at it very black and white, I think it's true. But I think McCartney, I think maybe I'm Amazed wasn't bad. You know, maybe if what they're talking about is that it was an album, it was more complete as an album. It didn't just have one or two good little tracks, and I think it was an album. It was a very hairy album to make.
Well, you had the band breaking up. You had difficult conditions in Nigeria.
Well, they were building the studio when we got there. You know, we thought they would have it finished, but they... You want a booth? Sure. So, yes, put some glass in the windows. Oh, glass, okay. So it was like, it was pretty funky, you know, making that album. And Nigeria is a pretty funky place. I thought Lagos was going to be the sort of rhythmic capital of Africa. I had no research or anything. It just sounded good. Actually, our rover, arrived at it was I asked EMI for a list of their studios, because they got millions around the world. They've even got one in China, I think. It was
amazing. And Rio sounded good. I thought, Rio de Janeiro, and that sounds because the rhythm and all that. But then I saw Lagos. I thought, well, gotta be African stuff, because I love African music, you know. And but it was quite a funny job when we got there. And I was mugged one night and stuff. Oh, it was crazy. So it was quite an experience, that. And, of course, the weather wasn't even good. It was like monsoon season. Mud pouring out the skies and that. Red mud. But again, you know, who knows? Some people say that that's what makes good albums, you know, all that slogging and suffering for art. I hate to think that myself, actually.
When did you realize it was coming through so
You
well?
Didn't use that what, clip, the, did the you, album, for your... For your
I think when we were mixing
traveler,
it, really,
Band on the Run,
that it was starting to actually come
together. No.
We had a good time out in Africa, but
that would
it was
have been
hairy,
a good,
as I
nice
say, recording, so we were bothering more
Looking
about
back on it now.
What was going yeah. on. Jeff Emmerich engineered that, and Jeff is one of the great engineers. So I was in his hands on the sound and stuff, and he really did a good job on all that. But it was only when we got it back to London and started mixing it that we thought, yeah, this isn't a bad album.
He's done paying for wireless bundles with things she doesn't.
At least it was before the song got going.
To Verizon.
Yeah.
And now.
I love seeing Joe English rock out.
Oh, he. Yeah. He goes to town with the drums during the whole show.
Like
Animal. Like Animal, like from Fraggle Rock. It's the same kind of thing.
Or Muppets, you mean?
Yeah, Muppets, same thing.
So I hate that it jumps. Of personnel changes that happen in the band, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you like to think that if
it's
get
not
bad, you'll just get
yeah, it's not chronological at all.
Work and stuff.
Right.
I think one of the main things was they were very conscious of being the follow-up to the Beatles. I mean, I know when the Beatles broke up, I think all of us thought, follow that. Because I mean, it's not easy to just go and get another band. In fact, a lot of people just wouldn't even attempt it, you know. That was why I went very basic and didn't try and sort of come in with the new Beatles or anything like that. That's why I wanted to go the back route kind of thing and try and work the band up. And if we were
going to
be
that they got all
that,
the lineups correct
then
here.
We would have done it on
yeah,
our own merit,
from
not
all
just
of
on
them.
The fact
yeah.
that I'd been
yeah,
in the Beatles.
Yeah, every mock.
But, yeah, there were a few personnel changes in there. We were trying to get it right, really. That's all, you know. Various people were leaving. We'd have arguments and stuff. That's bands.
Back to the Egg turned out to be the final Wings album. Was it actually meant to be the final Wings album?
No. No. I think the group just broke up after that, you know.
Sort of fizzled out?
Fizzled out, yes, like an egg fizzling out. I can't remember, actually, why it sort of broke
nothing
up.
Nothing to do with a drug bust
say,
or anything,
you know,
right?
It wasn't
or...
easy doing the band. And we had a lot of problems and stuff, and that wasn't one of our better albums. We'd come into it thinking it was going to be quite good, that one.
That's a
it's
shame.
It's a sort of concept album,
say
actually,
that.
Isn't it, all the way through?
It ended up being a bit of a concept, yeah. But,
sucks
did it with
to
Chris
say
Thomas.
About such a great album.
I know.
Chris was never that happy with the sort of work. that we were getting together. I mean, we were having a good time and stuff, but, I mean, when you've done, like you say, 15 albums since the Beatles, they can't all be good. I mean, you know, I defy anyone to... Who is there whose every single album is a cracker?
The Beatles.
I mean, you know, I can't think of anyone.
Yeah.
The Stones have duff albums occasionally. Elvis certainly had duff albums. Some of the people I like the best, you know, you just can't do it. You can't get it right all the time.
Nice. There he is. There's our buddy. And our other buddy who we met this year.
Yeah. Yes, we did.
Steve Holly's in the ballroom. Go, quick.
Beeline, straight to him.
Oh. Yeah, we've met three of the people. I've met three of the people in this incarnation of Wings. Have you seen that video? He actually did play this live in like some South American club thing. Have you seen that?
No.
YouTube it. He plays like a kind of reggae version of it on stage with a band in somewhere in South America.
Okay.
It's pretty. It's to see him sing "Goodnight Tonight," even in a kind of broken half out, you know, what half-ass way. It's still pretty cool.
Right. Imagine if he brought this out live over the last 20 years.
Oh, man. Well, it's part of that pre-show mashup warm-up music that gets you all fired up for the concert.
Was McCartney 2 almost a sort of...
Oh, this is a good quote here coming up.
...birthday solo, yeah. Birthday present for you?
A little bit, yeah. I sort of realised I hadn't done the McCartney solo working on your own thing. And there were only a few of us at that time who were doing it. Stevie was the major one who could play everything. And I'd enjoyed doing that on McCartney 1. So I thought, well, I'll have a go on McCartney. We ended up calling it McCartney 2 because of its similarity in concept. Really, on that album, I think most of the time, a lot of the stuff
that
wasn't finished.
Quote during Wingspan.
You get a thing and you think, that sounds nice. And you mix it and you think, it's bare. It's very sort of simple, but I like it. Mm-hmm. And maybe listening to it again, you'd think, well, I might have done that a bit different or something. And I discovered what I don't like about synthesizers on that album, which is, you know, they can often be very cold and thin. They don't sound like real instruments sometimes. It's a bit of an art, actually, to get a synth sounding good. People now, the good players now, have mastered that art. But then that was my first sort of try at it. But, you know, there's always a couple of little things I like on those albums. You know, I met some Aussie on a train the other day. He said, you know my favourite track? Waterfalls. That was off that album. And that's one I would have said was very sort of bare and unfinished. But
see, that's such a long moments like that.
And then they cut
Beatles, none of us wanted to work with George. It wasn't that we didn't
want to. Was that Broad Street footage?
We all would have loved the discipline.
No, the Waterfalls video got cut.
Oh, yeah.
George has.
Yeah.
But it was that he'd been associated with the Beatles. And now the Beatles had broken up. And people were saying,
that's another thing. So
Beatles,
he doesn't
George
mention
Harrison
George Martin as a
ex-Beatles.
Possibility
you know,
of why Wings,
we
you know, broke
particular
up.
About that. We were trying to make this new career, and they were still trying
still,
to throw us back in the old career.
I'm
so
surprised he didn't kind of like take
Beatles,
a shot
that's
at
why we never did
Denny Lane as well,
tours.
Because this is right around the time
do,
where they were,
do a Beatles song for
you know,
things were hairy here.
Would you just sling in a little bit of
You know, they'd ask for it and stuff. And once you did it, you saw how much the audience liked it. So with George, it was just to not really work with anyone would be so that the critics wouldn't say, oh, he's gone back with, you know, he's trying to do a Beatle again. But the attraction of working with George was that I like him very much as a producer. I mean, he really knows what he's doing. And just to be getting back with someone as professional as that and not just be goofing off on my own was a nice thing to do, you know, just because I love him anyway. I mean, when we turned up here to do Please Please Me, originally John had written it, and it was like a Roy Orbison song. It was come on, ching ching, come on, ching ching, please, please. Yay, go Roy. And it was very slow. Jum, 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 that stuff. There was a lot of people into that at that time. And George said, now, you know, perk it up, lads. Please, please. Oh, bloody hell. Can't do it that fast, George. Do you think we are, you know? But he was right, you know. So he made a lot of those kind of decisions for us, and that's a big help when you're trying to make a record.
Ah, here we go.
This is... Yep.
Your fave.
I still remember the first time seeing this video that my grandparents found. They had this on, and it was just a magical moment.
Oh, you would just crank it up, right?
Yeah. And this one, they're gonna make you wait.
John Hurt.
When you've diversified, you quite often have diversified into pictures, films, like Magical Mystery Tour and, of course, Broad Street. Mm. Now, the critical failure of Broad Street... How
both
does
of them, Magical Mystery Tour too. Yeah.
Does that really bother you?
Yeah.
On what level does it bother you?
Human level. You know, nobody likes to have their wrist slapped, you know. Nobody likes it. You don't like it at school when you get the exam results and you haven't done as well as you thought you had. And it's the same, you know, you think you're doing something good and you put everything into it and you don't get it right. So nobody likes to be told they don't get it right. In fact, what's happened with Magical Mystery Tour, I think, is that now
so people like
it's
Spielberg.
Got a lot of people who like it. Whereas what happened was it actually came out on, I think it was Boxing Day or Christmas Day, and it was what I call the Bruce Forsyth slot. You know, it should have been, hello, viewers, how are you? Happy Christmas? Had your Christmas pud? It was that slot, and it was all, we mean walrus, you know, and it was just not what the majority of those 20...
Meanwhile, people in the States watching this have no clue what he's saying.
None.
So it got kind of slammed, I think, from that kind of angle.
And shot
but,
shown in black and white.
You won't find any other footage of John Lennon singing I'm the Walrus. I mean, I think that's a great sequence.
And he's been using Broad that quote
Street,
for a while now.
I think for what people expected it to be.
True.
You know, and what I hoped it would be, you know, like Raiders of the Lost Ark Part 2.
Well, that's a bit of a stretch. That's a bit of a stretch.
Work on every single level. But it obviously didn't.
You don't think it's possible that because you starred in it and you produced it and you also did the music that you just got too close to it?
Yeah, I think it's well possible.
Yeah.
It's highly likely, in fact. I mean, if I was doing I think there were a number of mistakes on that. I think somebody on the whole team of that, because it was, after all, a features team, somebody should have said to me, we'll look
George
at your rough
Harrison
draft.
George Harrison told you.
Because I just wrote.
Not to do it all yourself.
First draft. I wrote it and said, this is roughly what I want to make. Somebody should have done a first, second, third, and fourth draft of it. And it should have been really experienced screenplay writers. It was me. And I don't really know anything about that. But it brought to it this same sort of you know, you can get away with calling it innocence or naivety or something, I suppose, in the long run. I don't think it was that good a film, but the same thing, I don't think it was that bad. I think there's some good sequences in it, you know.
Hiya.
Hey.
All right. Listen, have you heard the news?
What news?
You know, about the tapes?
What about the tapes?
Well, Harry, you know, is supposed to be taking them down the factory. He's gone missing.
Missing?
Yeah, and the tapes, too.
Harry and the tapes are missing?
Yeah, they've been phoning him all night. Nobody seems to be able to raise him.
Well, who's looking for him?
Don't know. Great news, isn't it?
Oh, God. Well, what are we going to do? You know, I don't fancy recording them again.
No, no need to do that. I mean, you don't think Harry would go and do a stupid thing like that, do you?
Yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
Ready to do one?
They came up with a clever way here because Ringo didn't want to play on the Beatles track, so they just made believe that his couldn't find his drumsticks for the Beatles song. All of a sudden, by the time Wanderlust comes around, he's playing. Doing?
The medley.
What medley?
Okay, Paul, I'd like to hear a run through of you, don't mind.
Okay.
There's Jeff.
About stage musicals. It was an area you could easily exploit if you wanted to get into it.
Yeah. When we first started off writing,
and he would have if it wasn't for COVID.
The composing teams that had gone before, like Rodgers and Hammerstein, had been 20 years before. But when you thought of composers, that there was that to it, Lerner and Lowe, and all of those sort of famous teams.
Lerner and Lowe is the way to go.
I think just off the end of that, we kind of called ourselves Lennon McCartney. Been a bit of a dispute as to which way round it was, but as usual, John got his way, so it was Lennon McCartney. So I think that influenced a couple of people to say, you know, Lennon McCartney, Rodgers and Hammerstein, why don't you do a musical? It seemed like a logical thing to do. And some of the songs we were doing would have, if they, you know, if you take some of the Beatles songs, you could put them into a pretty nifty musical. But in truth, we never liked that stuff. I like musicals more than John. John couldn't stand them. He used to walk out, King and I, he couldn't handle all that stuff. Oh, he just didn't like, it was always that terrible embarrassing moment, you know, where the sort of, you know, and then the girls, they all go dreamy, and then it's, and he couldn't handle it, you know, he'd always get up and leave. So if anyone ever asked, you know, you're going to do a musical, no, it was quite firmly put out of the picture, that one.
Could it happen now?
I don't know. I think it's, in a way, it's sort of too easy to just sort of string together a few songs and get somebody in and put on a show.
But you could.
I don't think it'd be that easy to do, but a lot of people have sort of done it, and they're not really very good musicals, I don't think. You know, the way I think of a musical, I mean, I think something like West Side Story, even though it's got all these those little moments that are embarrassing, it still is a very strong musical, I think. and I think my thing is, unless I could get something as good as those old musicals, as complete and as satisfying as some of those, I wouldn't really like to attempt it, you know.
A couple of months ago, you did a terrific live appearance at the Prince's Trust Gala. Has that actually inspired you to go out on the road again yourself?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd...
It did.
You know, yeah. In a word.
Yeah.
I'd like to do that, you know. I enjoy getting up there and sweating a bit, you know. The funny thing about that was they rung me up and said, we'll do Sora Standing There and Long Tall Sally. And we didn't know about Get Back till later. And I said, yeah, you know, sounds good to me, you know.
I'll keys, right? He's talking about the keys.
I was mine ringing Paul up.
The day before it, I was in the studio and I picked up my guitar. Just I thought, I'd better practice it. It is 20 years, after all, since I've done Long Tall Sally. So I picked up the guitar, thought, right, I'll just see Long Tall Sally, G. Go there. Go there. So it went G, F sharp, F, E. Gonna tell Aunt Mary about it. It sounded like Pat Boone. I thought, oh, no, you know. Because he did some pretty rough versions of some of Little Richard's stuff. So I thought, oh, no. You know, because it was a long time ago, so I thought, gonna have
picking
to be
on
in
Pat Boone.
But when I got to the rehearsal, I told him it was going to be in G, and I didn't dare tell him I was going to switch it to E. So just the adrenaline, just I thought, right, I'll just have a go.
He was 44 at the time. He no problem hitting it. He had no problem doing it when he was in his 60s.
Right.
think this was the one where Mark Knopfler.
Yeah, I think there he is. Yeah.
So this was filmed a month later. The special was filmed a month later.
Yeah, right after it.
You're in competition with yourself, in a sense, though.
I don't really feel a big thing towards that, but I mean, I see what you mean. I like a lot of the early stuff, and I think some of it's got a good direct simplicity that I find myself sometimes. On this new album, I've tried consciously to sort of get back to some simpler stuff, you know, whereas you might try...
Not a lot of talk about the new album other than the couple minutes of press. Stuff.
Right, right.
Things like She Was Just 17, you know what I mean? It works. It's not very clever, but it works. So that kind of simplicity, I do like, and it, in that respect, like I sometimes try and get back to a bit of that. But I said originally, I don't try and analyze too much. I think it's dangerous. It's like believing your own myth, you know, your own myth. I try and keep away from all that. You know, I just try and write instinctively, and hope it comes out right.
It's a tug of war. So, you know, to end with tug of war is kind of interesting, too. I mean, here he is trying, they're plugging press, but yet they go back from.
We're going back to, back 4 years ago to, well, because, you know, up in, that was one of his bigger albums for the whole 80s, the biggest one.
Yeah, I get that, but, you know, still.
You would think it ended with what he's trying to promote, right? I get what you're saying. Right, yeah. Or show the video. Yeah. Well, the video for press maybe wasn't done yet by then. I don't know.
No, maybe. But then maybe do that video footage here.
Show it. You know, show it on the going out. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Maybe, I don't know, but.
Never a fan of this video anyway. Really.
Yeah.
You know, show me Paul playing, Paul doing it and singing it with Linda.
Right.
And we're not going to end the show, of course, without an ad from Lincoln Financial. Thanks so much, Lincoln Financial, for wasting my time and everybody else. And I got to wait 15 seconds for it, too.
Bafungu.
Oh, big Bafungu. And another one.
Oh, we get two. All right.
Seagulls.
Does anybody ever get anything for the ads they see anywhere? No.
USA. Booking.com. Booking.com.
Yeah.
Book this. Yeah. Book this. We'll be dancing to the beat played on
a different drum. All right, roll the credits.
It's a tug of war.
Yeah, if it just was Paul. I mean, I get the footage of the tug of war in the 40s and stuff, but let's just see Paul playing, shall we?
Right.
But I can't let go. If I do, you'll take a tumble, and the whole thing is gonna crumble. It's a tug of war.
You don't like that. I know you can't stand this part. You hate it. You don't. However, bridge, middle eight.
In years to come,
win.
They may discover what the air we breathe and the life we lead are all about.
All right, so they can lower it. But,
Wait.
Soon enough.
All right.
No, it won't be soon.
Thanks to Abbey Road Studios.
Soon enough for me. So, yeah, I mean, all in all, this is a pretty...
It's produced in association with MPL Communications, so it's not an MPL production. It was done by the BBC jointly. So we'll see. The BBC definitely still owns the rights to it.
Probably, but for its time, this was, I would say, a well-made,
think about it. In the '80s, to get a one. This is before the Put It There documentary and all those making of the album documentaries that you got. So it was not really that much about Press to Play. It was more of a history look back, you know.
Right.
That's the YouTube version. You'd have to really kind of, if you have the VHS or a way to play it, you'd have to look and try to find the full, you know, unedited version. That was a heavily edited version that we had there. So,
well, I mean, 4 minutes worth.
it's not complete.
It did edit out Hi, 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 and it did edit out Waterfalls.
But you make a good point. For its time, it was a very good documentary and a look at where Paul was as a mid-40-year-old. Trying to stay hip and relevant with the likes of, you know, Genesis and Phil Collins. And that's why he had Hugh on this album. He wanted to try to stay contemporary and current.
I mean, if you're a newer McCartney fan, let's say you're just getting into Paul McCartney and you see those clips of Wildlife and all those early video, you know, the Hell on Wheels video and stuff you'd never, I mean, if I was seeing that at real time, I mean, my eyes would just be popping out of my head.
You'd be like,
what am I, you know?
It's a gold mine. It's a gold mine of footage. Yeah. And it's hard to look at that now. Right. But that's why, you know, I went to the library and I'm like, how much can I buy this tape for you off of? And I think they were like, give us $5. I think I got my granddad to get it for me. I said, can you get this for me? And he bought it for me.
Oh, way to go, granddad.
Yeah.
Grand dude.
Yeah. So again, it's if you have this, it's on YouTube. I mean, we presented it here for you on our show and, hopefully you enjoyed it. If you hadn't seen it before, I think most Mac and diehards and followers of our show definitely have seen it, if not heard of it. And, it was good. It was worth a trip back to go watch again, even though we have the Bruce McMouse show and we have everything else, you know?
Right. Absolutely. And then this would be great, too. I mean, let us know in the comment section. I mean, if you saw it real time, do you remember watching it for the first time?
Yeah. Did you watch this on the BBC? Did you get a copy? Did you buy a VHS type tape of it, you know, in America or in the UK?
Right. Yeah. And what were your thoughts? I would imagine, you know, the older fans, you know, if they were lucky enough to go see the university tour, they'd be like, oh, I remember that. You know? And that would have been really cool.
Yeah. Anyway, so Thomas, to close out, what are you up to with your own movie channel and Talk More Talk?
Well, Talk More Talk has taken a little bit of a break. We got the 4th of July. I mean, by the time this is posted, 4th of July will be over. And we're going to do something Ringo for the next episode. And, my movie channel, Tom's movie channel, check that out.
76 is the next year you did, right?
Well, I just did a video I'm doing a series called Five Favorite Films from Each Year I've Been Alive. I just did 1976. However, by the time this is posted, I might have done a couple more because I really want to try to get that series over. Going because, you know, covering 50 years, you know, that's going to be a lot of videos to try to get done. So check that out. That's Tom's Movie Channel on YouTube. And Andy, you got your own channel as well.
Yeah, two somewhat recent videos. They're a few weeks old now. They're up there, our Barry Manilow review and the review of The Musical Box. That's the latest that's on there for me. I will be going to see Peter Gabriel and Steve Hackett later in the fall, so I will definitely have reviews of that. About a month apart, actually, too. I think I'm seeing Peter Gabriel in September, and I'm seeing Hackett in New York City in October.
Great.
So those will be excellent reviews to have up on our channel as well. But
is Hackett doing a full album again or something?
Foxtrot.
Like Foxtrot. Oh, very good.
Foxtrot at 50 and then a smattering of other stuff too. So yeah. Right. So that'll be a great show to go to as well. Great. Other than that, that's about it for us. So that is going to wrap it up for episode 213. On behalf of my partner, Tom Hunyadi, this is Andy Nichols signing off, and we will see you next week on a brand new episode of Two Legs. So thanks for watching, everybody, and stay well and be well. Peace out.
Take care.
Listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. Podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan.